All right, and welcome back to A Businessman's Guide to Almost Everything, the show where I, your host, Cole Brzezinski, get to sit down with interesting people. We get to have interesting conversations, picking apart their field, their industry, and some of the things that just fascinate them. So today, I'm sitting down with Troy Luganbill. Mm-hmm. I got that right? Troy, how about you introduce yourself and what you do?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. My name is Troy Luganbill. I am currently the manager of Linden Village Books and Paper Dreams. Previously managed, directed and curated the Linden Pioneer Museum, now Linden Heritage Museum. And before that was a bookseller at the Little Professor Book Center in Gig Harbor.
Brilliant. So today's episode, we want to go over myths, unpleasant truths about Linden, and I'm sure we'll kind of expand to other myths and unpleasant truths just about history in general. But let's start off with Linden, this quite small American town known for being Dutch, known for being very reformed and Christian. Has it always been such a rosy picture?
No community history ever is really a rosy picture. No. There's a lot of people that move here, certainly these days, for perceived cultural traditions. And I'm all for it. It's the traditions that they're perceiving are good traditions. It's unfortunate that many of them don't understand why those traditions exist. And I think that's probably usually the reason that you see communities change, is because a new group of people will move in. They don't have the cultural frame of reference. And so consequently, while they may have moved in because they like their traditions, they don't understand the traditions. And so consequently don't carry those traditions forth the way they would if it was part of the culture that they, you know, originally grew up in or had an understanding of.
Is this some like immigration problem? The immigrants the problem here?
Well, certainly. I mean, you could broaden that out to an immigration situation. I'm not just talking Linden, but I mean just the history of the United States, general immigration, and how that has affected U.S. history and with changing communities. One of the ones I'd previously talked about was a Chinese history professor at Tacoma Community College. One of those professors that sort of caught my attention for history and culture. He talked a lot about early Chinatown on the West Coast, the Chinatowns on the West Coast. That was one of the things he talked about, was how much those Chinatowns changed because there were multiple waves of generational immigrants coming in. And so when you have a community in which has had an immigration come in, they know the piece, the next generation knows it. The new group of immigrants coming in may not necessarily know why it's being done that way. And so consequently, it becomes difficult to explain. Probably the best known piece in the case of Linden is Sundays, at closures on Sundays, drinking and dancing on Sundays, drinking on Sundays, these pieces, because they're the most recent in Linden's history and probably the most pervasive of Linden's history. It's a discussion that was going on before the Dutch even arrived here.
No kidding. It is interesting because, with the whole, just the generational aspects. Like, I get with the migrants point, but then at the same time, when you have people who come in and the generations that come by, they either assimilate, they become the dominant culture, or they homogenize into something entirely different, which, and like, you can look at Caribbean histories and...
Caribbean histories are a great example of that.
Yeah, you have entire languages where... like the Pidgin and Creole languages specifically, where there are these amalgamations of different cultures, different tradition, different languages, and you get something completely new.
You talk to people in Europe and they'll say, like, that's exactly what English American is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We use more Germanic, Slavic, things than any English speaker in England.
No, absolutely. And I'm Canadian. I was born there and I grew up in Ottawa. So it's right on the Quebec border. And Quebec's probably one of the most... historically speaking, interesting societies to ever come around, because one of the things about languages is that they always change. And there's only ever been, as far as I'm aware, one exception to a language that's not changed for like 300 years, and that's Quebec French. If you go there, it is the same French that they were speaking like 1730 France. The French in France today do not speak that French anymore.
Right.
It's a completely novel, weird culture. And I don't... People have tried to write books on it.
But. That's a great segue into sort of the Dutch aspect. With the Dutch settling, when the Dutch were arriving and settling in the United States, ultimately then many of them arriving in Linden, the reason those Dutch came was because Holland at the time was changing drastically. Economically, culturally, it had become a modern country. Okay. And it had become one of the very first global societies.
Holland.
Yeah.
Really?
Because the Dutch East Indies and the Dutch West Indies were the single two largest trading fleets in the world.
Mm.
And they outnumbered the next biggest trading fleet, the English, by like a factor of three.
Wow.
Yeah. So if there were three English trading ships at a given port, there were going to be nine Dutch.
Jeez.
Yeah. So the Dutch were one of the first truly, not just, I mean, Amsterdam and the Dutch cities were not just some of the first truly global cities.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Netherlands as a whole became a community of globalism.
Because I remember before England really rose to dominance in the naval world, it was the Dutch as well.
It was the Dutch. Yeah, the Dutch. When the Dutch still, the Dutch never had a military navy that could challenge anything.
Mm.
And the Spanish navy particularly liked picking on Dutch merchant ships.
Mm.
But then when the English defeated the Spanish, leaving the English as really the only real navy out there,
mm-hmm.
the Dutch said, great, the English aren't going to pick on us.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to build more ships. We're going to trade more ports. I mean, the Dutch were the first trading colony for North America, with, of course, New Amsterdam and I can't remember the other one. New Amsterdam ultimately becomes New York,
mm-hmm.
And then for China as well, because even though the English had taken Hong Kong.
Oh,
wasn't Beijing?
It's the one with all the casinos.
Yes,
it starts with an M. Macau.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. So the Dutch had also already established a large trading colony in Asia, mm-hmm. by the time the English had, and so the Dutch were the traders of the colonial world.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones that created and supported that global economy. And it all ran through Dutch banks.
Yeah.
And that's the reason Holland is still such a wealthy nation and is just simply, they're looking at 400 plus years of lots of profits and lots of interest. On those profits.
So. It is funny because I think the closest nation that England obviously took over a third of the world effectively. And there's no other nation quite like England because only the English could do what they did, except for the Dutch.
Yeah, and see, the Dutch never wanted to colonize.
No.
They just wanted to trade.
Mm-hmm. And like they weren't as isolated as England was, and that probably affected their culture a mm-hmm. little bit. But outsized influence on a global scale, huge.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were to look at the influence on globalism that various countries have had,
mm-hmm.
Netherlands is still one of the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
And was for many centuries probably was at least in the top three.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I mean, for sure. The U.S. wasn't even in there. It would have been, yeah, England, Spain, and Netherlands, basically.
And I think that point should really be emphasized. Like Portugal colonized, France colonized, Spain colonized, England, of course, did. The Netherlands, they had like a few small disparate colonies, but never the same footprint.
Right. And their intent was never to export Dutch culture.
No.
Unlike everybody else.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what the thinking was behind that, because that's not par for the course for Europeans at that time.
Well, and that's one of the things that goes to the aspect of Protestantism, and especially Calvinism.
Mm.
Calvinism is not a go out and get new adherents.
Yeah, it was far less inclined than some of the other Protestants, especially. Yeah. Yeah.
So the Calvinists weren't out there saying, hey, come be like us.
Mm.
Hey, come be Calvinist. And most of the Calvinism that was going on in agricultural and rural areas.
Mm.
So that becomes one of the impetuses, because as globalization is occurring in urban areas, it is changing at least part of the religious landscape of Holland. And so much of those Protestant Calvinists, the really hardcore ones, left to the New World, which is the only place they were going to find any given religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, again, they didn't bring their culture to teach it to everybody else. They brought their culture as their own piece.
Mm.
You know, their intent was never to make everybody else Dutch.
Mm.
You know, their intent was, well, and it's great because talking to some of the really old early Dutch immigrants to Linden when I first started at the museum, mm-hmm. I remember one lady was telling me, she's like, because I was asking her, like, you know, so what is it like to be Dutch in America? She looks at me funny. She says, I'm American. I'm not Dutch.
Mm.
I stopped being Dutch when I immigrated. but you still speak Dutch. You still, you know, do these things. She says, those aren't Dutch things. Those are church things. I speak Dutch because I'm supposed to, because that's what you speak in church.
Mm.
I dress this way because that's how God intended you to dress.
Right.
You know? And so it's interesting that what the Dutch carry that people think of as Dutch culture isn't actually Dutch culture. It's rural Calvinistic Dutch culture.
That's interesting. Cause that's one of the things that I've noticed a lot, just like everyone knows it, but in especially Latin America, you see that Catholicism and Latin culture, very integrated. In a lot of other Protestant, I think especially in like the English Protestant world, there is that division between what is cultural, what is civil, and what is church. Mm-hmm. Just greater divisions between those. The Dutch, that line was a little bit more blurred, a little bit more Catholic then.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things that does bother a lot of those early Dutch immigrants in the late 1800s, early 1900s is the burgeoning of new religions across Holland.
Mm.
Because after Catholicism, Holland became Protestant of many different types.
It's a Duke of Orange.
But the reason being is because under Catholic occupation, they were treated so horribly. Why mm-hmm. would anybody want to be part of a religion like that? Why would anybody want to be part of a church that does that? So of course they became Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they became, for lack of a better term, militantly Protestant.
Yes.
You weren't going to change their mind now that they were Protestant.
They would flood the country if they have to.
Exactly. They were not going to let Catholics or anybody even looking like Catholics anywhere near Holland ever again.
Mm.
And so consequently, then you get the globalization.
Mm.
And again, you get not just now Catholicism, you're getting all those different new mm-hmm. Protestant groups, the new Reformed groups, the new Catholic groups. You're getting Eastern Orthodox Catholic Church. You know, you're getting a global mix now of mm-hmm. religions. And many of the Protestants of Holland were like, no, Holland's disappearing. The Holland I love is gone.
Mm.
It's nothing but a bunch of, oddly enough, probably what a lot of them would say now, nothing but a bunch of liberal, progressive, globalist elites, you know, trying to push their religious views down my throat. So they went elsewhere. Most of them came to the United States and Canada because religious freedom was sort of guaranteed and was one of the few places in the world at that point in time that would guarantee your religious freedom.
Right.
But again, they didn't come here to make everybody else Protestant.
Mm.
They just came here to be allowed to practice their own Protestantism, their right. own Calvinism, be their own religion, do their own church. Other than that, like I said, it was interesting because they were American other than that.
Mm.
Outside of church, they would dress like Americans or what they perceived to be American dress at the time.
Right.
Type of a thing. But if you went to church, you wore specific. I mean, they used to wear what you think of as the church Dutch Sunday going clothes.
Right.
You know, so it was interesting. But that's the first wave. Then you start getting different waves coming. And it's interesting to see. It was interesting to see the difference between the post-World War II Dutch.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that because huge amounts of Dutch came to Canada specifically, I know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that was the Dutch government in exile went to Canada. So Queen What's-Her-Name and the King lived out there the Nazi occupation in Canada.
I did not know that.
And Dutch troops even participated in some Pacific theater aspects.
Really?
Yes. Oh. Yeah. And then the Dutch, other Dutch military would under Allied rule. Oh, I'm trying to remember which battles. There was a couple of battles in which Dutch military in Europe were, but they were not Dutch. They were Dutch conscripts in the English army, if that makes sense. There was some way England was very good at doing things like that, where they would take other countries' militaries and fold them in
right.
to their military.
Mm. Yeah, that is a very English thing to do. This is a bit of an aside, but I remember always going through the histories and I see all these great things about what the English did. It's like, oh, that's cool. But I'm pretty sure Canada was in here too. I'm pretty sure Australia was in here too. Yeah. I was like, oh, wait, that was us. They just took the credit for themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about being part of the Commonwealth.
Yeah. The
queen takes, and there's one thing that I think is now really sort of a funny aside, and that is in 40 years, because Prince Harry was born in the United States, he'll be eligible to run for U.S. president.
Oh, my God. Not
Prince Harry, Prince Harry's son.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, so those English, that English monarchy is always thinking ahead about the colonies.
There's going to be some American patriot on the East Coast. It's like, I'm pretty sure I fought so that this didn't happen
exactly.
again. Exactly. All right, that's good. Okay, so keeping loosely with Lyndon.
Yeah, so with that, so they bring these traditions, and for the Dutch, these are church traditions. They're traditions they're absolutely not going to change. Mm. And already in Lyndon, you had some level of support. Although Lyndon was, Lyndon's first church was a Methodist church. The first church in a vast majority of U.S. and Canadian communities was a Methodist church, simply because the Methodists were really good at getting circuit preachers out there. Mm-hmm. If you're a Methodist man back then, you got yourself baptized as a pastor, and you headed out into the West to bring the, you know, God to the infidels type of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, the first church in England was a Methodist church, but it was really an ecumenical church. Mm. You had Baptists. Baptist church was the second church in Lyndon. So you had Baptists going there. Phoebe Judson wasn't Methodist. She helped establish it as a Methodist church because the Methodist church would supply a pastor and would supply all these, basically pay for the church. Mm-hmm. But she was an avowed Christian Scientist.
Christian Scientist? Really?
Yes. That's one of the myths that are still people in Lyndon who do not want to accept that she was Christian.
So what does that exactly entail? Because we're talking 1870 for Phoebe Judson. Mm-hmm.
Christian Science comes out in the the burgeoning teachings of Christian Science, and I cannot remember, there was the two main authors, for life I can't remember their names, are in the 1850s, 1860s. Christian Science as a denomination really doesn't establish itself until the 1880s.
Huh.
But she had in her her belongings, what's left through the family, her letters. She refers to those early authors of Christian Science teachings. She later attends the first Christian Science church in Bellingham when she's still alive. So she was even coming to Lyndon.
It seems like a
Christian
pretty,
scientist.
Seems like a pretty heterodox belief, then.
What do you mean by heterodoxy on that one?
It's outside of what is typically orthodox. So,
all of Christian Science was. That probably still is my Christian beliefs.
But that's the thing. Like, I'm vaguely aware of Christian Science. Mm-hmm. Like, can you unpack some of the distinctives?
The most important aspect of Christian Science is that Christian scientists believe that science is the measure by which we can find the measure of creation, and that the Bible is almost entirely metaphor. So the Great Flood did not happen. It's a metaphor, and science can prove it. But then Christian Scientists can also turn around, and there are aspects that they look to. Some of the things we were talking about is concepts of repeating patterns of, you know, accession events, or just that absurdity is God's hand.
Right.
And so Christian Scientists will turn around then and say, but look at the frequency by which these things happen. There is no other way by which this can happen in a purely mathematically chaotic system.
These natural phenomenons that are so coincidental and random by the mere fact that they've happened in such a way that this is allowed, this good deed has happened.
Yeah.
That's providence. Yeah. That's the Lord's working. Okay.
Right. So that would be the equivalent of a miracle. Christian scientists felt that they could prove miracles in a scientific fashion, using, you know, the scientific method as opposed to the religious method of philosophical or logical debate.
So that really does mean then that this church that was first being established in Lyndon, a lot of divergent thoughts. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So Lyndon's general divergent. Generally, the pioneer Lyndon would have been religiously very diverse, probably with Methodism and Baptism as being the two main, most recognizable of those religions.
So it wasn't until the Dutch came with the Calvinistic Reformed traditions that there wasn't really a clearly dominant church then.
No, you're not going to get something like some of the communities that you'll find back east and in the Midwest where they were settled. by an ethnic group initially. There was nobody there per, you know. So like the town my Luganville family hails from, Burn, Indiana, is a Mennonite community.
Mm.
The Mennonite church is like the only church in, and it is the single largest church,
yep,
you know, occupying blocks in the middle of town.
I've got Mennonite family. I've seen those kinds of towns.
Yeah. So, you know, and that was what many of those pieces did, but the Dutch didn't do that. The Calvinistic Dutch didn't do it because they weren't coming to settle as Dutch. They were coming to settle as Americans.
Right.
But maintain their Protestant Calvinistic views and maintain their church views. And so what that means in Linden is that when they get to here, although there is a diverse view, there are diverse views religiously in Linden, some of those pieces, there are already views that may not be religious views that can be taken up and were already championed by Protestant Calvinists. One of those being the issues of Sunday, the Sabbath, working and drinking and dancing. Okay. So while on one hand you would have Phoebe Judson, Ed Edson, the first pastor of the Methodist Reformed Church, and a couple members of, Dr. Lucy Sarg, what was her name? And then like maybe a couple members or the first pastor of the First Christian Reformed Church sit down, and they would disagree on the tulip principles and what type of grace is saving grace. And as we've discussed, that legalistic aspect of Calvinism, but they would all agree on the moral aspects of certain things, such as resting on a Sunday.
Okay.
In Phoebe Judson's book, A Pioneer Search for an Ideal Home, she talks specifically about how her trip across the Oregon Trail was made easier because they observed the Sabbath on Sundays. They were one of the few that, instead of trying to make it across in the shortest period of time, would take every one day of rest every 6 days.
Right.
And consequently, they would, even though they would watch as these guys would pass them, by the time they got close, they'd pass them. You know, so it wasn't just a good idea from that God gave us. It was a practical idea as well.
Interesting.
Okay. Similar situations in regards to dancing. Dancing led to impure thoughts. Impure thoughts led to infidelity or adultery or pre-marriage consummation.
Figure that one out.
You know, and so consequently, the best thing, just don't dance. Don't tempt yourself. You know, liquor, same thing.
Right.
You get drunk, you do stupid things. Why get drunk in the first place? So this was the logic that existed among many of the pioneers here. And so when the Protestant Calvinism arrived with all these same ideas backed up with the Word of God, it became real easy for then Linden to go ahead and say, we're already doing that. So yeah, keep doing it. More power to you. You're just another reason to keep people from working on a Sunday and not drink and not dance. And, but it was still an American community, right? And it was still the West.
So it seems like the primary defining quality then of Linden really was this, I want to say conservative, not in strictly the political sense, but more in the temperamental sense. It was this conservative Christian town.
Not even a temperamental. It was just a conservative town, a temperance town.
Like, it knew what it liked, it knew what worked, and it wasn't interested in bringing in too many new radical elements.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
How do you think that compared to the rest of Whatcom County, though?
Oh, wow, that would depend upon the community.
Oh, that much, eh?
Yeah, I mean, Bellingham, all the border towns, Bellingham, Blaine, and Sumas were going through constant cycles of boom and bust based upon what resources were being used at the time.
Right.
So Bellingham starts out a big fisheries town, lots of fish. The fishery starts going away. Coal mines are there. So then the coal mines pop up. A lot of people. Then the coal mines start going away. Then it's the gold rush. And by that point in time, there's enough general population in Bellingham to keep Bellingham going. But at one point in time, early on in the 1870s, Bellingham and Linden were about the same size. There were about 200, 300 people.
Nowadays, you'd be forgiven if you didn't know that.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You know, and that's the thing. It's a Sumas. I love Sumas history because it is just constant boom and bust based upon what's going on either side of the border,
right?
And whether or not that town is situated in a place to take economic advantage of that and what's going on across the border. So, and in Blaine is similar, only you had the fisheries going with it.
Right.
So it had a long, strong history of the fisheries. Mm.
I suppose Blaine also had a smaller history of being flooded out like Sumas does.
Well, there is always that issue too, that Sumas is not exactly the most ideally situated place geographically.
No. Good heavens. Yeah. Okay. How about this one? This is a fun one. What's a funny historical take that you got for Wacom or Linden? Were there any particular events that were especially outrageous?
Yeah, you know, the one thing that I love the most is from a Linden standpoint is some of the characters that came out of Linden. Mm. I mean, I know that there are characters that come out of every community. But when in the case of Linden, just some of the historic characters are just some of the most unique. And it amazes me the reach that their voices had as well. You get some of the more serious ones like Saul Lewis, editor of the Linden Tribune.
Okay.
Okay. His grandson still runs the Tribune. Mm. So I think it is one of six, one of very, very few surviving family-owned newspapers left in the United States.
That few. Wow.
Yeah, big time. I mean, there are small newspapers in the U.S., but newspapers that are still like third or fourth generation owned, very, very, very few. And unless one of the Mike's great-grandkids steps up to take it or something, it's going to be one of those drops off the list, unfortunately. Oof. But so you had Saul Lewis, who during World War II became a voice of the nation on NPR radio for telling his tales of Parsnip's Corner, which was basically him telling tales out of school of things going on in Linden, because Linden was such an iconic small town during World War II.
Really?
Yeah. You get Ed Edson, who is the most militantly pacifist person I've ever run into. He at one point called for the sheriff to arrest the U.S. military draft, or not drafters, but the U.S. military guys who were coming to draft, had signed people up for World War I.
Mm.
His son signed up for World War I, went off, his son Gail Edson, and Gail went off to serve solely in the Army Medical Corps.
Mm.
His father was such a pacifist that doing anything in regards to World War I was just anathema. He wouldn't talk to his son for years afterwards.
Really?
Even after his son came back. And they ran the same Edson drugstore. I mean, they would work in the same store. And literally reports were that Ed would say something along the lines to a customer, "Oh, thank God you came in. Would you tell Gail?" Even though Gail had been with them for the last hour.
Wow.
And he could have easily just turned to his son and said, "Gail, would you do this?" So you get that. You get Billy Waples, who it comes from effectively nowhere and runs one of the most successful department stores in the history of the United States, and is recognized by business schools across the nation as an honorary alumni for being such a successful business person.
Really?
And he wasn't just regarded as a successful business person from a standpoint of his ability to run a business and sell things. Mm. But his ability to have that business be an integral part of the community. Mm. There's a tale.
Okay.
So where I work now, Village Books is in the Waples building, built in 1914.
Right. Yes. Okay.
That building burned back in, let's see, reopened 2015, Ted, but about 2004.
Oh, the fire was 2004.
The fire was 2004. It was empty for about 10 years. I was the curator at the museum at that point in time, and it was interesting to see, because I'm just down at the museum and suddenly somebody comes running in. "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, the department store is burning."
Mm.
And it was amazing, because by that point in time, it wasn't a department store, hadn't been the department store for 20 years. It was Delft Square after some rebranding. But everybody in town still called it the department store, not Delft Square.
Ah.
The department store is burning. Everybody went, I mean, you saw the entire town converge on downtown until there was just this crowd of people watching this building burn. And there was this really, really strange feel. It wasn't that normal feel of, oh my God, it's a disaster. Look, it's a burning building. Sort of that, that reaction of an entire group getting together and going, that's too bad. That's going to, you know, everybody agreeing this is a horrible situation.
Right.
It was a feeling like somebody had gutted Lyndon.
Oh.
I mean, just gutted, thrown it to the ground, kicked it, strangled it. And just, it felt like Lyndon had died. Mm. And for years afterwards, that's how the community acted. I mean, people would be like, well, the Lyndon department store's gone. Lyndon's done for. There's downtown's going to collapse. Might as well just move now. Mm. Lyndon is just going to become a wasteland. There's no reason.
Might as well just go down to Bellingham.
Might as well. Yeah, literally. People are just like, might as well just move to Bellingham. There's no reason to stay in Lyndon anymore. Now the department store's gone, Lyndon's gone.
Jeez.
So it amazed me that a business person had built a business that was so integral to the community that the business, not having lived there for 20 years, a generation having passed, still had so much physical presence and power in the community. That the community literally, that building is the heart of Lyndon. I mean, it's the physical, and if it beat when it was living, it would be the living heart of Lyndon.
Okay.
I mean, and when it was brought back and reopened as the Waples building, it was just like, oh my God, Lyndon can breathe and be alive again. You know, I mean, it was just amazing because I had, as an anthropologist, you always hear about these centers of a community, but usually they're areas, like, you know, you hear about the downtown area of, or the such and such neighborhood, or, you know, as being the core of that community's identity. But for a singular building to be that core.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And by all accounts, he was an amazingly generous person. The rumor had, when I first started, the rumor was that Billy Waples supported Lyndon through the Depression by giving out loans. And there were no proof of that. It was just sort of this general knowledge that Billy Waples had managed. Lyndon would have gone down if it wasn't for Billy Waples during the Depression.
Right.
So one day somebody comes down, is like, hey, Troy, I was actually the owner of Del Square at the time. You want to come and see what we found? We're doing some remodeling in the very upstairs of it. And we found a door and an unknown office. And there's a whole bunch of books. Thought you might want to come down and take a look at them. So I'm like, sure, my job. Let's go do it. It's always interesting. So I went down, and there's just, and it's just a room, maybe about 10 feet by 10 feet, 12 feet by 12 feet, you know, a small office, one window, an old desk, and a bookshelf with just a bunch of business journals ranging anywhere from about that thick to that thick.
Oh.
And so I pull them off and I start looking through, and I realize these are the sales receipts journals, the accounting journals and everything from like 1910 through 1960 something. Suddenly realize, so I start looking through and just pulling them off to see if I can find. And so finally the first I pull off is 1932. And I'm like, yes, here it is. The accounting proof. Did Billy Waples actually carry Lyndon through the Depression?
Wow.
And took it to, at the time, Boyce Rapley Ross, which was, the accounting firm that we worked with, Boyce Rapley, Ross, Brittany bought it later. Boyce Rapley, who's the accounting firm we worked with, Anna Greta Boyce, who is still alive, was one of the founding people of the museum. She was one of those visionaries. So Gabe, I just like put all this thought and I was like, okay, here's the chance. Let's answer it. Let's see, is the myth real? And so she spent a month going through those books with her partner, Marilee, and came back and they said, yeah.
Wow.
At least from 1928 to 1936, Billy Waples gave out millions of dollars in loans in charge accounts to the people of Lyndon, seeing next to nothing back on those charge accounts until after World War II.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So, and so yeah, Billy Waples literally carried Lyndon through the Depression.
And he just ran a department store.
Yeah.
What kind of department store was this? Good heavens.
Just general department store. Had a grocery, it had a hardware, men's, women's clothing department, kitchen area, you know, everything. It was just a general department store. Sears, like you would think it's Sears catalog. I mean, you could buy anything you needed to or order anything you needed.
He really must have been killing it then.
Oh, he was. I would not, I mean, I don't know, but I would not be surprised if he was the most wealthy person in Linden at that point in time, if not one of the most wealthy people in Whatcom County and even in Washington State.
Jeez.
I mean, he was very successful at his business. But he was also, the department store wasn't just one of the ones he ran. Mm. 1904, he starts a shingle mill just up by Fish Trap Creek where the walking bridge is. Waples Shingle Mill goes in because it's the height of the shingle boom. I mean, anybody could make money off of a shingle mill. So he starts a shingle mill. And him and Ed Edson get together and they're talking about this new steam power technology and this new generator technology and how lights in cities are really awesome. And boy, wouldn't it be neat to have how all the people they could bring to Linden if we had electric lights downtown. Mm. So they start the Waples and Edson power plant that ran off of a steam engine using the sawdust from the shingles that were milled.
Oh, that's funny.
So they start Linden Light. He then has also, by this point in time, started all sorts of, he had his own line, Linden Department Store seed potatoes, Linden Department Store eggs, you know? Mm. I mean, he was a smart guy. Mm. I mean, he's one of those people that you sort of, you know, you get that question. If you could go back and meet anybody in history, who would you like to meet? Mm. I would really love to sit down and have a beer with Billy Waples and just pick his brain.
No kidding.
Because he saw things that people couldn't see and then would make a lot of money off of it.
Hey, credit to him. That's not easy.
No, it wasn't. I mean, he was invested in the phone company. I mean, if he didn't initially start the business as a successful new business to Linden, he was probably invested in it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Ah, geez.
So, and then the flip side was he wasn't cutthroat about his pieces. So one story is, and this is an absolute true story because a fella, Everett Zeidmeier, saw him do this. Everett's dad ran Linden Bike and Tire. Mm. Okay. And which is almost directly across from Linden Department Store. And Linden Bike and Tire was having a hard time because the department store was capable of selling them for cheaper.
Right.
And at one point, Billy Waples sort of heard through the grapevine that he was having a hard time. He went over and he said to Everett's dad, "You're having a hard time. I understand that this is probably because of the competition that I'm offering. You know, I just want you to know that I'm going to make this right." So he went over and got all of his bikes from his inventory at the Linden Department Store, brought them all over to Linden Bike and Tire, gave him the inventory, sold it to him for pennies on the dollar, and said, "I'm not going to carry any bikes or anything anymore.
Wow.
You're the guy."
Oh, my word.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, he was one of those guys that was capable of saying, "I've got more than enough. There is no reason I can't share." And he was just his generosity. Once a year, he threw people call it Billy Waples Day. It was really the Linden Department Store anniversary sale. but he would make clam chowder by the gallons and fresh biscuits and this feast and invite everybody in Linden for free down. And he would feed them for a day. That was his way of saying, "Hey, thank you guys for supporting the Linden Department Store."
That's a nice thank you.
Yeah. So like Billy Waples, the man, the myth, the legend he's an interesting fella. He's one of those people that you look at the wealthy today and complain about in the United States. Mm. He's the guy that you would have looked at and he would have broken that rule.
Right.
And said that just because you have money doesn't mean you have to be an asshole.
Mm.
So, okay. So again, you know, another one of those people, Phoebe Judson, I would, you know, sit down, talk to her. I mean, she was apparently quite a character. I mean, there are just any number of these really amazing people in Linden. I mean, I'd love to sit down and talk to Indian Jim and Indian Sally. Why did they, after Colonel Patterson had been there and treated him like crud, I mean, he was a real jerk. Did they see the two people moving into his house and decide, "Hey, I think we're going to help these guys"?
Right. You know? Yeah, no kidding.
It's there's again, some amazingly generous people that I guess let me put it this way. I like to look at Linden's history as being built on the generosity of people who didn't need to be generous.
Mm. That's a good way to look at it.
You know, and I think that's one of the reasons that the traditions of Linden are here so much, the reason it's such a clean town, is because people walking in Linden, they don't need to stop and pick up a piece of garbage, but they will. You know, it's just that aspect. I would hazard a guess that Linden has got one of the highest levels of volunteerism in any community in Whatcom County, let alone any community in the United States. It's whether they're volunteering for, you know, and not even you take out the church aspect. I mean, everybody I know in Linden volunteers somewhere.
Right.
So.
Man, it's a heck of a pitch to come visit Linden, man.
Well, it is. But if you do come, you got to be prepared to carry forward those traditions.
Okay, well, then last question, then we'll close it out. Because we've talked about this a little bit. Or no, actually, I was talking about this with someone else. I'm getting my conversations mixed up. Linden, along with the rest of Whatcom County, is expected to grow by something like 40% with respect to its population in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
How do you think Linden's going to respond?
I think Linden is going to respond the way it is already beginning to respond. I mean, the city council has already out and out stated, both the mayor and the city council, that they are going to do their best to limit growth.
Really?
And control growth.
All right.
Because they don't want one runaway growth. They don't want what's happened to Bellingham.
Yeah.
They don't want what's happening to Ferndale. Even Ferndale has come out and said, yeah, guess what? We're slowing it down too.
Yeah, like Ferndale was trying to keep up for a bit. They're like, oh, this is too big.
Yeah, and now we're, so I mean, most of the communities in Whatcom County outside of Bellingham are embracing that. No, we're a small community. We're going to remain a small community. We're going to do our best to try to limit and control that growth as much as possible. And so far, Linden has done an outstanding job. I mean, it is still considered one of the safest communities in the United States, let alone Washington State. And the reason is because one of the points that the city council and the past mayors have made is that they want to have both a police and a fire department that is appropriate for the level and concerns that go on in Linden. They're not going to hire police officers just because they think they need to. But they're not going to let those police forces slip below the necessary to keep Linden a safe place.
Right.
You know, so the city council, I think they do a good job. I mean, looking forward and managing. I mean, they're actively managing. And they're actively recognizing that uncontrolled growth is really the detriment of what most communities, I think, at least in the West Coast, have faced and have failed.
All right. Well, Troy, thank you again for this conversation. I enjoyed it, as always.
Well, me too. Thank you for inviting, and look forward to many more in the future.
Yeah, well, we at least have one more on the books. The next one, you know, it's going to be a surprise. You guys will have to come back to see what it is.
So, ooh, I like what you did.
There we go. Troy, thank you for joining me for the conversation.
And thank you.
Until then, you guys have a good one and take care. See you next time.